Okay, I think we're ready. Let me call the meeting to order. Good morning. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board on July 13, 2010. I'd like to welcome those of you who have joined us here today in person and those listening on the webcast. Today, the board will consider a recommendation to propose a new auditing standard that would supersede the board's interim standard on the confirmation process. Also consider related amendments to the board's auditing standards. Before we proceed with the agenda, I'll note for the record that all of the board members are present. The only order of business today is the recommendation that the board propose the new auditing standard on confirmations and present the staff's recommendation. We have staff members from the office of the chief auditor here, so let me turn the floor over to you, Mr. Baumann.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. We are pleased this morning to recommend that the board propose a new auditing standard related to confirmation. One of the board's existing standards at AU 326 pertains to evidential matter. Among other things, it states that when evidential matter can be obtained from independent sources outside an entity, it provides greater assurance of reliability for the purposes of the audit than that secured solely within the entity. The proposed confirmation standard, which would supersede the board's existing confirmation standard, clearly reflects that view regarding independent third-party evidential matter and thereby strengthens and extends the requirements for using confirmations in the audit process. We therefore believe this proposed standard will improve audit quality and further investor protection. I'd like to ask Jennifer Rand, Deputy Chief Auditor, and Dee Miranda Gould, Associate Chief Auditor, to highlight major aspects of the proposed confirmation standard. First, however, I'd like to thank Jennifer, Dee, and Chris David, all from the Office of Chief Auditor, for their outstanding work in developing this proposed standard for the board's consideration today. I'd also like to thank our colleagues in inspections, enforcement, and AURA, and in particular Bob Burns and Nina Mujeriazad of the Office of General Counsel for their thoughtful insights. Finally, I'd like to thank the staff of the Securities and Exchange Commission who provided timely assistance and advice. Jennifer?
Thank you, Marty. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. As Marty mentioned, we are pleased to be here this morning to recommend that the board propose a new auditing standard on confirmation. In developing this proposal, we considered comments on the concept release that was issued. We also considered input from the board's standing advisory group, the board's inspection and enforcement activities, academic research, as well as actions of other standard setters. The proposed standard that you have before you includes two major sections, the first on confirmation of specific accounts, and the second on confirmation procedures. I will provide an overview of the section on confirmation of specific accounts, and then Dee will provide an overview of confirmation procedures. In the area of confirmation of specific accounts, and as Marty mentioned, the proposed standard is based on the view that evidential matter obtained from independent sources outside the entity provides greater assurance of reliability for the purposes of an audit than that secured solely by the company. For this reason, the proposed standard includes three areas where confirmation procedures are required for specific accounts. The first area relates to receivables. The proposed standard retains the requirement from the board's existing standard for the auditor to perform confirmation procedures for receivables because a confirmation response from a confirming party can provide relevant and reliable audit evidence of the existence of receivables, and academic research supports the effectiveness of confirmation procedures in testing the existence assertion for receivables. The proposed standard further expands the requirement to receivables that arise from credit sales, loans, or other transactions because confirmation procedures can provide audit evidence to address the risk of material misstatement due to fraud. Additionally, a company might have a material receivable from the sale of assets or from the sale of a business, which otherwise may not get included under the current standard. The second area is in the area of cash and other relationships with financial institutions. This is not a required area of confirmation under the board's existing standard today. However, we have observed that cash is generally confirmed by auditors, and further, many large firms require confirmation in this area as part of the firm's audit methodology. The proposed standard includes this requirement because confirmation procedures can provide audit evidence to address the risk of material misstatement due to fraud, and because of the importance of cash to a company's liquidity and ongoing operations. In addition, properly designed confirmation procedures can provide audit evidence regarding other relationships with financial institutions, such as lines of credit, other indebtedness, compensating balance arrangements, and contingent liabilities, including guarantees. Finally, the third area is in the area of significant risk. The proposed standard requires the auditor to perform confirmation procedures in response to significant risks that relate to the relevant assertions that can be adequately addressed by confirmation procedures. The board's current standard includes several areas that are risk-focused, where an auditor should consider performing confirmations for certain items, such as unusual and complex transactions, and terms of unusual agreements or transactions, such as bill and hold sales. Many respondents to the concept relief suggested that a new standard should focus on risk. In considering this comment, we thought it was appropriate to require confirmation of significant risk because a significant risk is defined in the board standard as a risk of material misstatement that requires special audit consideration. We believe the confirmation requirements in the board's existing standard for items such as unusual and complex transactions would likely be a significant risk. The proposed standard does acknowledge, however, that confirmation procedures might not be specifically responsive to every significant risk because confirmation procedures might not adequately address the relevant assertions. For those areas where confirmation procedures might not be specifically responsive, confirmation would not be required. That summarizes the overview of the three required areas of confirmation: receivables, cash, and significant risk. However, before I turn the floor over to Dee, I would like to mention that the proposed standard states that even when a significant risk does not exist for a particular account balance, transaction, agreement, or other item, confirmation procedures still might be an appropriate response to obtain audit evidence for certain relevant assertions regarding that particular item. This statement is intended to encourage auditors to think about other areas where confirmation procedures might be an appropriate audit response. With that, I will now turn the floor over to Dee Miranda Gould, who will provide an overview of the requirements for confirmation procedures. Dee?
Thank you, Jennifer. In response to confirmations received on the concept release, the proposed standard retains existing requirements and includes additional requirements regarding maintaining control over the confirmation process. The proposed standard indicates that maintaining control includes determining the information and selecting the items to include on confirmation requests, selecting appropriate confirming parties, designing the confirmation request, including determining the type of confirmation request to send and determining the confirmation request to properly address, directly sending the confirmation request, and requesting responses directly from the confirming party. I will discuss several of these areas of maintaining control in a little more detail. The proposed standard requires the auditor to design confirmation requests to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence and includes factors for the auditor to consider when designing confirmation requests. These factors include the assertions being addressed, the specific risk of material misstatement, including the risk of material misstatement due to fraud, the nature of the information to be confirmed, the layout, presentation, and content of the confirmation request, prior experience on the audit engagement or similar engagement, the method of communication, whether it is in paper form or via electronic or other medium, the company's authorization to the confirming parties to respond to the auditor, and local customs that might influence confirmation responses, such as the local custom of responding to confirmation requests without verifying the information. In developing the proposed standards, the staff took into account comments received on the concept release that negative confirmation requests may provide audit evidence in limited circumstances. The absence of a response to a negative confirmation request provides significantly less audit evidence than a response to a positive confirmation request. Therefore, unless the auditor receives a response. The auditor does not know whether the intended confirming party received the confirmation request and verified the accuracy of the information contained in the request. Consequently, the proposed standard states that the auditor should not use negative confirmation requests as the only form of confirmation request to address the assessed risk of material misstatement at the assertion level, except in certain circumstances. However, because negative confirmation requests provide limited audit evidence, even when all of these factors are present, the auditor is required to perform other substantive procedures to supplement the use of negative confirmation requests. The proposed standard also requires the auditor to perform procedures to determine the validity of addresses on the confirmation request, including substantive procedures or tests of control. If the auditor identifies an invalid address, the auditor is required to investigate the reason for the invalid address and attempt to obtain a valid address, evaluate the implications of the invalid address on the auditor's planned confirmation procedures and the auditor's assessment of the relevant risk of material misstatement, including fraud risk, and on the nature, timing, and extent of other procedures, and to perform other audit procedures designed to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence with respect to the account balance or other item if a valid address cannot be obtained for the confirmation request. As part of maintaining control of the confirmation process, the auditor is required to send the confirmation request directly to the intended confirming party or intended intermediary and not permit the company or any other party to send the confirmation request. In addition, the auditor should request that confirming parties or intended intermediaries respond directly to the auditor and not to the company or any other party. If a confirming party sends a confirmation request or response to anyone other than the auditor should contact the confirming party and request the confirming party resend the response directly to the auditor. The proposed standard also includes requirements to address when management requests the auditor not to confirm certain accounts, balances, or other items. In that situation, the auditor should obtain an understanding of management's reasons for the request, obtain audit evidence as to the appropriateness of the reasons, and determine whether management's request is appropriate. If the auditor agrees to management's request and does not confirm certain accounts, balances, or other items, the proposed standard requires the auditor to evaluate the implications of management's request on the auditor's assessment of the relevant risk of material misstatement, including fraud risk, and on the nature, timing, and extent of other audit procedures. To perform other audit procedures designed to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence with respect to accounts balances or other items not being confirmed, communicate management's request to the audit committee or the equivalent body, include management's reason for the request in the management representation letter, and evaluate the implications for the audit report. The requirement in the proposed standard to maintain control over the confirmation process limits the auditor's ability to use internal auditors to perform certain procedures in the confirmation process. As mentioned before, the proposed standard requires the auditor to send the confirmation request directly to intended confirming parties or intended intermediaries, and not permit the company or any other party to send the confirmation request. It also requires that the request to request the confirming parties or intended confirming parties respond directly to the auditor and not to the company or any other party. And the auditor should evaluate the audit evidence obtained from performing confirmation procedures and not rely on the company or any other party. Therefore, the auditor cannot use internal auditors to send confirmation requests, receive confirmation responses, or evaluate audit evidence obtained from performing confirmation procedures. In the evaluation of confirmation procedures, the proposed standard requires the auditor to evaluate the audit evidence obtained from performing confirmation procedures and not rely on the company or any other party for this evaluation. The evaluation includes performing appropriate alternative procedures for each non-response to a positive confirmation request, investigating each exception in confirmation responses, assessing the reliability of confirmation responses, including performing additional procedures for electronic confirmation responses, considering the effect of disclaimers and restrictive language on confirmation responses, and evaluating results to determine whether relevant and reliable audit evidence has been obtained. The proposed standard requires the auditor to perform appropriate alternative procedures for all non-responses to positive confirmation requests, because a non-response to a positive confirmation request might indicate a previously unidentified risk of material misstatement, including a fraud risk. The proposed standard includes a new requirement for the auditor to investigate all exceptions in confirmation responses to determine why each exception occurred and whether any exceptions individually or in the aggregate are indicative of a misstatement or of a previously unidentified risk of material mistake. An exception might indicate, among other things, a previously unidentified risk of material misstatement due to error or fraud, or deficiencies in the company's internal control over financial reporting. The proposed standard includes requirements with regard to electronic confirmation responses. In assessing the reliability of the electronic confirmation responses, the proposed standard requires the auditor to take into account risks that the confirmation process might not be secure or might not be properly controlled, the information might not be from a proper source, and the integrity of the transmission might have been compromised. The proposed standard also requires the auditor to perform procedures depending on the form of the electronic communication. If information is provided via facsimile response, the auditor should verify the source and contents of the facsimile response by directly contacting the intended confirming party. If information is provided via an email response, the auditor should verify the source and contents of the email response. If an intermediary is engaged to facilitate confirmation, the auditor should obtain an understanding of controls over the procedures used by the intermediary to process the confirmation requests and responses. The auditor should perform procedures to determine whether the auditor can use the intermediary's process. If information is provided via direct access, the auditor should evaluate whether direct access is an appropriate means to confirm the information about the particular item that is the subject of the confirmation request. The proposed standard includes a requirement for the auditor to evaluate the effect of disclaimers and restrictive language on the reliability of a confirmation response. If a disclaimer or restrictive language causes doubts about the reliability of confirmation response, the auditor should obtain additional appropriate audit evidence. The proposed standard also requires that, to the extent a disclaimer or restrictive language precludes the auditor from treating the response as a confirmation response, the auditor should treat the response as a non-response and perform appropriate alternative audit procedures to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence. This concludes our remarks on the proposed auditing standards on confirmation that we are recommending the board propose today. The release includes a number of questions for which we are seeking specific feedback. We also would encourage comments from interested parties on topics for which we have not proposed specific questions. The staff recommends that the board issue the proposed auditing standard for public comment for a 60-day period ending September 13, 2010. Now we would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me ask my fellow board members if there are any motions concerning this matter.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Gradison.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board instruct the staff to release the proposed standard on confirmation and proposed related amendments to the board standards, as recommended, for a public comment period of 60 days.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I second.
Okay, thank you. Let me make a couple of comments about this proposal myself before we go ahead. The board is considering today a proposed standard that would update and expand the requirements related to the auditor's use of confirmations. Confirmation, that is, direct auditor communication with a third party about a particular item affecting the company's financial statements, is one of the building blocks of auditing. Because confirmation involves third parties, it provides a high level of audit evidence. Asking customers who owe the company money to confirm the accuracy of their balances is a familiar example of an audit confirmation, but there are many other aspects of financial reporting that can be the subject of confirmation procedures. Confirmation of receivables has been required in the United States since the SEC's 1940 McKesson-Robbins case, stunning fraud in which the perils of auditing that takes the company's word for what the receivables were dramatically demonstrated. The current confirmation standard, AU 330, was written more than 15 years ago. The proposed new standard not only modernizes AU 330, but also strengthens the confirmation requirements to better protect investors and other users of audited financial statements. The changes the proposal would make seems to me fall into three groups. First, the new standard would expand the scope of the confirmation requirement. At present, receivables only need to be confirmed if they arise from the sale of goods or services in the normal course of business. The proposal, in contrast, would provide that auditors should confirm a wider range of accounts that represent money owed to the company, including receivables from credit sales, loans, or other transactions. In addition, the proposal would require confirmation procedures in response to significant risks arising from other kinds of transactions or arrangements with third parties, if the relevant assertions can be adequately addressed by confirmation. The proposed standard also includes a new requirement to confirm cash held with financial institutions. Fictitious or misstated bank accounts have, of course, been the linchpin of several notorious frauds. Second, the new standard would update the requirements by addressing changes in confirmation practice. In particular, the new standard recognizes the prevalence of electronic communications, electronic record keeping, and the Internet. It would also reflect a lower tech kind of change, the increasing frequency with which respondents include disclaimers, limitations, and other legal boilerplate in their responses. Third, the proposed standard would more explicitly incorporate consideration of the risk of error or fraud into the selection, design, and planning of confirmation procedures. This is consistent with other board standard-setting projects, particularly the pending risk assessment standards, which I anticipate will have before us for final consideration later this summer. In its emphasis on fraud and other misstatement risk, this proposal dovetails with the approach in the proposed risk assessment standards. I'd like to also comment on how this standard fits into the board's standard setting process. In part, this proposal addresses observations made by PCAOB inspectors and illustrates how the board's inspections program and its standard setting work together. As the release notes, PCAOB inspectors have observed instances in which the auditor did not obtain sufficient competent evidential matter from confirmation responses because they included disclaimers as to their accuracy. The proposal includes a requirement, as I've already mentioned, that the auditor evaluate the effect of disclaimers and restrictive language on the reliability of a confirmation response. In addition, the development of this proposal reflects an effort to make the board's standard setting more transparent and to give investors, preparers, auditors, and other interested persons more opportunities to shape new standards. The proposal was developed based in part on feedback received through a concept release and through public discussion of the board's standing advisory group. The release and proposed standards text that we're considering today will, of course, afford further opportunity for interested persons to weigh in. I want to join in thanking the staff for their ongoing work on this project. Particularly want to acknowledge the hard work of Associate Chief Auditor D. Miranda Gould, who's the principal draftsperson of the release and standards. I hope that's okay to mention, D. Chris David in the Chief Auditor's Office and Bob Burns and Nina Ojari-Assad in the Office of the General Counsel have also played important roles in this proposal and getting this proposal to the board, as of course have Marty Bauman, our Chief Auditor, and Jennifer Rand, Deputy Chief Auditor. I appreciate everyone's efforts. I have some questions I wanted to ask about, but I think before I do that, I'll ask the other board members if they have comments they'd like to make or questions they'd like to ask, and then I'll try to come back and pick up anything that hasn't been covered. Why don't I start with the moving parties, Mr. Radisson and Mr. Harris. Anything either of you would like to
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I simply want to join with you in acknowledging the outstanding work that the staff has done on this proposal, and also indicate how important I think it is. I think it's extremely valuable and timely, and look forward to the time when it can actually take effect.
Thank you. Harris?
I also want to congratulate the outstanding work of the staff on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the staff recommendation the board publish for public comment the proposed revision to our standard on confirmations. As I said in my remarks at the open meeting last April when we issued the concept release, it is well understood that confirmations are a critical part of the audit process. One of the first prominent accounting and auditing cases, which you referenced, brought by the Securities and Exchange Committee in the late 1930s, highlighted the consequences of inadequate confirmations when the auditor failed to authenticate what turned out to be falsified documents of the pharmaceutical company McKesson & Robbins. As the SEC eventually found out, of the approximately $87 million in assets shown in McKesson & Robbins' 1937 year-end financial statements, over $19 million were entirely fictitious. These fraudulent accounts consisted primarily of inventories, accounts receivable, and cash. By the time the SEC exposed the fraud in December 1938, the $19 million reportedly had grown to about $21 million through more fraudulent transactions. These numbers are big enough today, but they were huge in the 1930s. One reason the McKesson fraud was not detected by the company's auditors was the use of inadequate procedures to confirm cash being held by what then was called a banking agent and a complete failure to confirm accounts and notes receivable. Today, over 70 years since the McKesson case brought the issue of inadequate confirmations to the public's attention, our inspection staff continue to see deficiencies in some firms' confirmation practices. As thoroughly explained in our release and in the draft standard, auditors use the confirmation process to obtain reliable audit evidence from knowledgeable third parties outside the company regarding the existence, completeness, or value of one or more of the company's accounts or statements. As others have already said, our proposal would expand the use of confirmation process to have auditors confirm receivables that arise from credit sales, loans, or other transactions, cash and other relationships with financial institutions, and when appropriate, other accounts or balances that pose a significant risk that the financial statements might be material misstated. Our proposals also would bring the confirmation process from the age of McKesson and Robbins into the modern age by recognizing and dealing with issues involved with advances in technology. Those issues include the use of electronic media to send and respond to confirmation requests. Some confirming parties also have indicated that rather than sending back confirmation responses, they prefer to allow the auditors to have electronic direct access to the company's accounts so the auditor may directly check the confirming party's records. We propose that this type of access could be acceptable, but only under certain conditions, such as when the confirming party represents in writing that is aware of both the auditor's confirmation request and the intended use of the requested information, and that the files to be accessed contain information responsive to the auditor's request. Our proposal also sets out specific steps that the auditor should take during the confirmation process. The use of the word should means that investors may presume that the auditor will take those steps unless the auditor can demonstrate that in the particular circumstances, alternative actions are sufficient to achieve the objectives of the standards. Some of these steps appear so basic, however, that it's hard to imagine how a confirmation process could be valid without them. Such steps include the auditor monitoring control over the confirmation process, the auditor designing confirmation requests to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence, and the auditor evaluating the audit evidence obtained from performing confirmation procedures. Be interested to see if comments from investors and other users of financial statements suggest that these and other steps should be mandatory and occur whether confirmations are used without exception. In other words, is it more appropriate for the proposed standard to mandate any of those requirements by using the word must rather than should? I believe that with the exception of auditing standard number 6, evaluating consistency of financial statements, this is the only standard that the PCAOB has issued or proposed that does not include any mandatory or must requirements. The board seeks comments on whether and how to revise all aspects of the proposal. Earlier in the process, The board heard comments from its standing advisory group, and this proposal incorporates views from that discussion. We are seeking input from all interested parties, including audit practitioners and financial statement users. It is important that the PCOB also hear from information technology audit and financial reporting specialists in considering the security implications of an electronic confirmation process. Most importantly, the board actively seeks the input of investors whose interests we are here to protect. I would also like to join you, Mr. Chairman, in thanking Dean Miranda Gould, Jennifer Rand, and Christopher Jacob from the Office of Chief Auditor, as well as their director, Marty Bauman, as well as Nina Majori-Mazad and Bob Burns from the General Counsel's Office for all their hard work in preparing this recommendation for the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Niemeyer.
Well, I also want to thank the staff and the standards and the Office of General Counsel for all their hard work. And Dee, Jennifer, Chris, and Marty, thank you for all your steadfastness and hard work for all this effort. And Bob and Nina, thank you for all your very helpful advice coming up with this product. I also support issuing this proposal for public comment. It includes several improvements over the existing standard, and in many respects would bring the standard up to the level of most firms' best practices today. For example, the proposal would require firms to perform confirmation procedures on the audit client's cash held by financial institutions. Confirmation of cash anchors the audit. Bank confirmations not only provide valuable information about cash balances, but they also are the best, and in many cases the only, source of information about other relationships that an audit client may have established with a financial institution but not disclosed to the auditor. This is why typically firms confirm such balances in the United States. I've learned, however, that it is not a consistent practice internationally, so I think it is a good idea to establish it as a requirement. I look forward to the comments, and I thank the staff again.
Thank you very much. Well, let me see if I can ask you a couple things that may bring out some points here. Some of these things have been touched on already, but first, as to receivable confirmation, this has been noted a couple times now that we're expanding the scope of the requirement to confirm receivables. At present, it's limited to receivables arising from the sale of goods or services, and the proposed standard would take in sales, but also loans that are otherwise on the books of the company, and receivables arising from what I think is the standard called other transactions. There are also some limitations or exceptions in the current standard related to materiality for one, and low risk coupled with effective controls for another, which we'd be eliminating. What do you think the practical effect of these changes is going to be? What will the effect be on the volume of confirmation activity in the, well, I'll say in the typical audit, I suppose there is no typical audit, but you understand where I'm going.
All right. Let me take a shot at that. I think that the proposed standard will probably increase to some extent the extent amount of confirmations that are performed during an audit. But given the reliability of the evidence that the auditor is receiving via that confirmation, compared to other procedures the auditor might perform, which might even be as timely or more timely, I don't think it will result in significant additional time to do that. And whatever additional time is clearly going to be outweighed by the value of the evidence received. In terms of expanding it, clearly there are certain types of other transactions, sales of certain types of assets or sale of part of the business of a company, which can give rise to very material receivables. And we think they should be confirmed as well. So limiting, as the existing standard did, to transactions in the normal course of business, sales of goods and services in the normal course of business, or financial institution loans, we think this expands it to a broader population, which we think will address risks of material misstatement in the financials, and we think provide more reliable audit evidence at not a great cost.
Well, you touched on costs at the end. You said you didn't think there would be a significant amount of additional time, and I guess time is money, and auditing is in other places. What do you anticipate that the cost impact of of this part of the proposal, would be this element of expansion?
Well, certainly we're asking questions in that regard about the comments in this area. But as I said, I think because of the liability of the kind of evidence one gets via confirmations, I think compared to the other type of evidence an auditor might try to seek in these areas, I think that there's quite an offset there.
What about the elimination of materiality as a limitation? If a company has little travel advances out to all the salesmen, is it going to have to confirm those receivables, for example, or just in general? What's the impact of eliminating materiality as an exception?
We discussed that in the release and indicate that we eliminated the exceptions that you referred to that are in the existing standard today because one pertains to materiality, and materiality is already addressed in existing PCOB standards at AU 312, and that gives the auditor guidance with respect to considering materiality in planning the audit, and the auditor should consider aspects of the materiality of receivables as part of the audit plan. So that, we think, is already addressed. Some of the other exceptions dealt with, you didn't have to confirm if confirmation procedures had been deemed ineffective. We were concerned that that's too easy of an out for the auditor. If the auditor was confirming the entire balance and wasn't getting their response back, we think the auditor should look for other ways, such as confirming individual transactions or invoices that comprise the entire balance to try to get the confirmation response. So, and finally, with respect to when it's a low risk, we eliminated that exception. Typically, receivables are tied to, oftentimes tied to revenue recognition, and our standards indicate that revenue recognition should be presumed to be a fraud risk, and therefore receivables are related to that revenue recognition generally. So we didn't think those exceptions were necessary, and that's discussed in the release.
Okay, well, let me go on to the new requirement then to confirm cash held with financial institutions. We've spoken about the concept release and the input that we got from the concept release. My recollection is that this was not a popular idea in the concept release, and it's not something that there was general support for there. I already touched on this earlier, but it might be useful to summarize what the reasons were for adding cash confirmation as a requirement, cash with financial institutions.
Yeah, I think a couple of the board members made reference to the fact that some of the more notorious frauds have occurred in the area of cash, and as Charlie Nehmeyer mentioned, confirmation of cash also enables the auditor to find out about a lot of other relationships with respect to the financial institution that the company might have, such as indebtedness or lines of credit or other things of that regard. So also in addition to that, I think our inspections processes and our review of firms' methodologies have indicated they're generally confirming cash today. And in many cases required by their firm's methodology to confirm cash. So again, I think this is an area, cash certainly lends itself to confirmation. You find out about other relationships with the financial institution. It's being performed largely by firms in the United States, and I think extending the requirement, making it a requirement, should enhance audit quality. So again, we don't think that this is likely going to increase cost significantly because it's done, we believe, so prevalently already.
And as you imply, I wonder if the largest impact of this change may be outside the United States rather than inside.
It very well could be outside the United States where the impact would be greatest.
You mentioned a couple of times that part of the rationale is that it may bring to light other accounts at the financial institution, and the proposal would require that the confirmation to the financial institution ask about the existence of other accounts in addition to those named in the listed in the confirmation. Does that have the effect of imposing a duty on the financial institution to not simply look at the confirmation, but to look more broadly at its relationship with the customer?
I don't think so, because the way we have added that requirement into this standard is pretty consistent with the existing, what I'll call, standard confirmation form used in most audits. Whereby it asks the financial institution whether anything came to their attention as part of this confirmation process of cash with respect to these other relationships. And so we're not specifically asking them to do additional work, but to advise the auditor if anything came to their attention about other relationships that the company has with the financial institution, in addition to those spelled out in the confirmation request. So we don't think it'll put a burden on the financial institutions either.
Because we don't have the ability to impose requirements on financial institutions even if we wanted to, but we can on auditors. Would the auditor have an obligation to understand whether the financial institution used procedures that would have brought other accounts to its attention, or can the auditor, in essence, accept the confirmation on its face?
We haven't added any requirements with respect to the auditor understanding the procedures at the financial institution with respect to the cash confirmation. I think that would be above and beyond the requirements. So the cash confirmation requires the confirmation of the cash balance, requires that the auditor inquire if anything else came to the attention of the financial institution with respect to any other balances or any other indebtedness or any other information. But doesn't require the auditor to understand procedures. I should add, though, sometimes the financial institutions are now using intermediaries to process their confirmations and confirm the balance with the financial institution, and then that can respond back to the auditor. When intermediaries are being used in that way, the standard does require that the auditor understand the procedures at the intermediary in order to process those confirmations and determine that those procedures are effective.
Okay, well, let me just touch then on the third element. There will also be a requirement that the auditor perform confirmation procedures in response to significant risks that relate to relevant assertions that can be adequately addressed through confirmation procedures. And that's sort of a broad obligation to look at other aspects beyond receivables and cash with banks that lend themselves to confirmation. And I think there was some concern expressed in the comments on the concept release that kind of requirement could erode, I guess, auditor judgment. The effect would be to simply require confirmation with respect to any transaction, I guess, out of the ordinary course of business or any agreement with a third party. What do you see as the practical impact of that proposal, particularly with respect to the idea of judgment? Concept of judgment.
Right. Well, with this, I'll take this one. This requirement is included in the proposed standard because the way the board has defined significant risk, it's a risk requiring special audit consideration. And our view that confirmations can provide very reliable audit evidence. And there's many significant risks can cover a wide range of things, which are such as a fraud risk. Whether the complexity of transactions, whether it involves related parties. And for those type of things, we do think it's appropriate where it can be confirmed that auditors perform confirmations on those items. There is judgment in determining what is a significant risk. So that requires auditor judgment. And further, whether it lends itself to being confirmed. So there is some judgment there as well. But otherwise, we do think where it is a significant risk and it's appropriate that auditors should confirm.
Yeah, that's kind of the point I wanted to bring out, what you said at the end of it. And there's a lot of high-level judgment that goes into identifying significant risks and, I suppose, also into what can be adequately addressed through confirmation. There was some discussion earlier about the use of negative confirmations. I wanted to ask about that also. As I understand it, AU 330 would let negative confirmations be used as the sole source of evidence under certain circumstances, and that would be carried forward in the proposed standard, but the conditions to using negative confirmations would be quite strict and would be altered in some ways. At present, the auditor would have to have no reason to believe that the recipients will not consider the request. Sort of a negative, an absence of a reason to think that they won't consider the request. That would flip in the proposed standard to be a requirement that the auditor believes that recipients of negative confirmation requests will give such requests consideration. What do you think the impact of that is going to be on the use of negative confirmations?
I'll take that one. We spent a lot of time considering the use of negative confirmations. And a fair amount of discussion among all of us with the rest of inspections and what they find and so on and so forth. We not only said that you have to expand the requirements before you can use them, but said negative confirmations always require additional audit procedures as well. So they can't be, they cannot be the only form of evidence. So even when negative confirmations are used, alternative procedures still have to be performed. One of the concerns with negative confirmations, of course, is the limited evidence they provide. If an auditor doesn't have a basis to believe that at least the recipient is giving the confirmation some consideration, then the evidence is even more questionable as to what they provide at all. So what we've said is that the auditor has to have some basis to believe, reasonably believe, that the recipient is giving that negative confirmation some consideration. If the auditor doesn't have that basis, really the confirmation is providing little or no evidence at all. So we think the requirement is appropriate, and it may limit the use of negative confirmations, quite frankly, but if it does, it will be limiting it because the auditor would be getting would be relying on evidence with really no basis for it.
Well, there is, I believe, a question in the release on the subject of negative confirmations, so it'll certainly be interesting to see what kind of comments we get on that. Let me ask about another sort of change that the proposal would make. Existing AU 330 has a footnote in it that talks about the use of internal audit. I mean, as I think you all said in your presentation, it's one of the fundamentals is that the auditor has to maintain control over the confirmations and the responses. But the existing standard does recognize that, notwithstanding that maintain control requirement, it's possible to use internal audit to provide assistance in the confirmation process. That statement or that reference does not appear in the proposed standard. What's the intention, or what do you envision in terms of the impact on the use of internal audit?
You're right. The standard, the existing standard, says that the use of internal audit is not precluded. We did not retain that footnote here, and in fact, in certain areas, as Dee mentioned in her opening comments, with respect to sending the confirmations, receiving the responses, and the evaluation of the evidence, that direct assistance would not be permitted in those areas, direct assistance by internal audit. We think with respect to the sending and receiving, I don't think that's going to be a significant additional amount of time, but we think the fact of losing control of the confirmation process by giving it to somebody else to send or letting somebody else receive that is a weakness in the existing process. So we've changed that requirement, and we also think it's appropriate that the auditor make the final evaluation of the review of the evidence on non-responses and exceptions and things like that. Internal auditors can be used to gather the evidence for the auditor to review, but the auditor has to make that evaluation of the evidence on exceptions. The standard, the release does say, however, that internal audit under existing standard AU 322, internal auditor, the work of internal auditors that they are otherwise performing can be considered by the auditor in assessing the nature, timing, and extent of their audit procedures. Thus, if the internal auditors and their work has been reviewed and their objective and their review is worked by, their work is reviewed by the external auditor, external auditor can consider the work that the internal auditor did in confirmations at a particular division or subsidiary in considering the extent of the amount of confirmation work that the external auditor will then do. So internal auditor can still be considered in that regard.
I just note that there is some discussion of this topic in the release, which I think people will find useful. You know, as we go forward here, we might think about whether any of that should be condensed into a note or something in the standard, because to what extent people keep the content of proposing releases in mind when they're applying the standard years down the road. Just a quick point. You referred earlier to the use of intermediaries and the auditor's obligation to understand the intermediaries process. It might be useful to keep everybody on the same page, or if you explain briefly, what an intermediary is. What do we mean by the use of an intermediary in the confirmation process?
I'll take that. what's occurred in practice is that intermediaries, an organization has come up, if you will, that establishes a relationship with a financial institution. In this case, most of these relationships are with financial institutions. And then also establishes a website where an auditor can actually request the confirmation of the banking relationship, and it processes through this intermediary process. So what happens is the intermediary makes sure the information is correct, makes sure it gets to the appropriate person at the financial institution, then makes sure that the information gets turned around and sent back to the auditor quickly and accurately. So they act, you know, to process the request and process the response, and the time frame is, just, from what we understand, is much quicker than a normal process, and the accuracy rate is supposed to be increased. Right now, it's mostly used with financial institutions. The possibility is that it could expand to other areas, and we are allowing that process in the standards, but we are also requiring that auditors consider the process, understand the process, make sure that they can, you know, consider whether or not they can use that process.
We felt we had to address this in the standard because, quite frankly, some financial institutions are establishing a relationship with these intermediaries and are saying that communication must be with this intermediary and that they will not respond to the confirmation. So if we didn't permit the auditor to use this, effectively, they wouldn't get a confirmation. But we are requiring, as I indicated before, that the auditor perform procedures so that they understand the controls and the processes at these intermediaries.
It's a business. If you're a financial institution, you get a lot of confirmations. You can outsource responding to them to the intermediary. I'm not sure if there's more than one at the moment or not, but you can outsource them. Do these intermediaries, will they be amenable to letting auditors understand what their processes are?
Now, these intermediaries are in place today, and based on our discussions with the profession, based upon inspections work with respect to auditors, firms are today able to visit with the intermediary, understand their processes, and perform procedures to determine that they're reliable. So we believe the intermediary is being amenable to working with the audited profession so that the auditor can perform the type of procedures that we're requiring in the standard.
Disclaimers. We've talked a little about disclaimers, which I guess people are seeing more frequently in confirmation responses. I mean, we confirm the information you provided, but we don't guarantee that anything we say is accurate. We have no duty to respond, and we disclaim any responsibility for any errors in this confirmation, that sort of thing. What our standard would say about that is that the auditor should evaluate the effect of any disclaimer or restrictive language. I guess that's true. It doesn't seem like a very helpful statement to the auditor. And one would hope that they were evaluating them with or without such a statement in the auditing standard. Can we give any guidance as to how auditors should react to particular disclaimers and restrictive language, or do we contemplate that we would give any such guidance?
This is a difficult area, and I think Jennifer is suited to handle this question.
Disclaimers is an area where inspectors have on numerous occasions written comments, deficiencies in this area. We thought it was appropriate to highlight, although we recognize that disclaimers come in many different forms, many different language can be used. And we also thought that even the same type of disclaimer, if it was included in one response versus another, it may take different forms depending on the nature of what's being confirmed and who the respondent is. So we really didn't think it was appropriate to include a list of what's acceptable and what may not be acceptable, and also thought that we may be constantly updating the list and so forth, and really thought that what we wanted to do in the standard was to get auditors to focus on disclaimers, because we have seen that that's an area where auditors aren't always doing that, to get attention to it, to evaluate it, to evaluate what that disclaimer may mean on the audit evidence, on the confirmation response, and to evaluate it, the overall implications, if it causes a problem or if they need to obtain sufficient additional audit evidence to get comfortable, because perhaps the disclaimer had such an effect that it really negated the usefulness of the response.
Do you think we care if there's inconsistency? In other words, if, just to pick one, Pricewaterhouse gets a confirmation back from Citibank that says on it, we don't guarantee the accuracy of this response, and their firm policy is, well, we weren't asking for a guarantee, so that's okay. If Gelser and Company gets that same response back from that same responding party and says, oh my goodness, not guaranteed, I guess I have to do some additional procedures in order to verify this balance. Does that matter to us as an organization?
I think it that sort of example should have some consideration by the auditor and what that response is saying and who it may be from. For example, in your instances of a large financial institution versus someone we've never heard of, Gelser and Associates. The large financial institution, if, you know...
I'm offended.
I was intended
to...
But the large financial institution, what we do know from meeting with auditors is that when they're just seeing disclaimers, oftentimes if they're seeing something from a large financial institution that would affect many audits, they often ask inquiries, why is that included, what does that mean, to get comfortable about it, around it, to determine what effect that should have in evaluating that confirmation response. With an entity that may not be known at all to the firm, or may only, you know, the firm as a whole may only be using that party once to send a confirmation, you know, they would, one, not know the entity, may need to do more to really understand what that means in that context, because it's coming from a different entity, whereas the other, they may have already obtained some evidence on what that means and set the assessment.
Okay, well, let me just ask one last thing. We talk a lot in our standard setting about taking the ISOs into account when we write standards, and of course, I mean, you see discussion generally about similarities and differences between our standards and the international auditing standards. It seems to me that this is one of the major areas of differences. I mean, the ISOs don't have a confirmation requirement, although they do have standards related to the use of confirmations when the auditor does choose to confirm. Why do we in the IAASB see this issue so differently?
I'll answer that because I've spent a considerable amount of time monitoring the activities of the IAASB, including when they consider the standard on confirmation. The IAASB has never required confirmation of any specific account, and in their recent update of their standard, there were some commenters, including from the AICPA Auditing Standards Board, that indicated that they would continue requirement of receivables and thought that was an appropriate procedure. Their standards are written for applicability in all types of entities and all jurisdictions, public, non-public. We believe within our jurisdiction and in the audit of public companies, recognizing the importance of confirmation receivables as an existing procedure, the case that required that, prompted that requirement, thought it was applicable to continue that as a required procedure, recognizing the frequent practice of confirming cash by many firms and a standard practice in the United States, and also significant risks requiring special audit consideration, and the fact that that confirmations can provide very high reliable audit evidence that it was appropriate for use of audits of public companies.
I do agree with that. I think the sort of the attitude towards confirmations varies widely around the world, and how much weight you can put on a confirmation response that you do receive back varies widely also. So I can see that from the perspective of someone writing standards designed to apply anywhere in the world, they might view confirmations a little differently than we do in our environment here in the United States.
We do note in the standard that the auditor has to take into account and consider the different customs and cultures in their confirmation process. So we don't want auditors simply just to send out confirmations and think they got back evidence in some places where confirmations may not be treated reliably in certain countries. So that's a consideration we want auditors to think of as part of the process.
Okay, that's all I wanted to ask, or at least all the time I'll take asking questions. Any comments or questions any other board members have at this point?
I've got some questions, Dan, and you actually asked one of my questions. But since it's not altogether clear and self-explanatory from the release or the accompanying appendix to the standard, maybe you could summarize for us, and I think you've done this in a second, for those people who are listening, and so that we have a more complete record. First of all, why do you think this proposed new standard will better protect investors than existing standards? And I think the standards does a very good job and doesn't get enough credit for the work they do. And I think that oftentimes we speak to one audience and not to a larger audience. So if you could go ahead answer the question in terms of why you think this proposed new standard will protect investors, that would be very helpful. And I'm going to ask all these two questions at every meeting that we have on standards, so let me get it out now so that you can be prepared every time. And I think I've asked them before. And the second one, which you have addressed, but if you want to expand upon it, why do you believe today's proposal is an improvement over analogous standards of the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board and the Auditing Standards Board of the AICPA? So if you could take both of those questions, I'd appreciate it.
I'll start, and I'm sure Jennifer and her D will add, because they're both good questions. The standard clearly has investor protection in mind. As I said in my opening comments, this strengthens the confirmation process, the standard, including maintaining control and how the process is done. But it also extends the requirements to areas that we've discussed at some length here, including extending it in other areas of receivables, including other types of receivables that might arise from outside the normal course of business. Extends it with respect to cash, and clearly some of the most notorious frauds have been around cash, including quite recently. And it extends it to significant risks. And significant risks are discussed in our proposed standards on the risk of material misstatement. And significant risk can comprise a number of things, including fraud risk and complexity of transactions, related party transactions, things outside the normal course of business. And so terms of a transaction, which could be a significant risk, we're requiring that significant risk to be confirmed if an appropriate, it lends itself to confirmation, that significant risk. So we think the extension of what we've done together, what we're asking the board to approve here today, significantly will improve audit quality and protect investors by the extension of the procedures that we have here.
Thank you. I might also make a comment that in the concept of commenters recommended the standard focus on this, and in writing the standard, you look to various areas to address risk of material misstatement. So in the evaluation area as well, in addition to the maintaining control area, evaluation area, there's a focus on considering risk of material misstatement. So for exceptions, non-responses, because all of them could be indicative of a risk of material misstatement due to error or fraud. So I think that's another area too.
With respect to the comparison with the other standard setters, the IAASB and the Auditing Standards Board of the AICPA, as we've done with other standards, and our practice now is to include an appendix in the release as part of this, which compares our standard to how we believe the other what the other standards require. Clearly, in this case, and as was discussed before, this standard has more requirements than the requirements of the IAASB or the ASB. We've spent a lot of time thinking about this area, and we think these additional requirements are appropriate. Clearly, they're appropriate for, in our view, for U.S. markets and for investors in U.S. securities. As I said, they extend the procedures in areas that are not required by the IAASB. The IAASB, as part of their confirmations material, indicate that they believe that evidence from a third party provides more reliable audit evidence as well. So they acknowledge that, as we do in our standard, but we go the next step of saying, well, it's more reliable audit evidence, but we require it in a number of areas. So that is a difference, and I'm sure we'll get some comments on those differences.
Well, I thought the summary was very well done, and I'm glad you've given the color and a little bit of the analysis, because the summary was a strict comparison, but the analysis in terms of why you think our standard and this proposed standard is a better standard was not included for obvious reasons, or maybe not for obvious reasons, but I can understand. So I think it's good to get on the record why you think our standards are improvements, because you do the comparison, but the bottom line in terms of the improvement is not totally obvious to the reader. I mentioned the past, but let me mention it once again with respect to our releases and with a little bit of a light touch. But the statute says in the very first section of Title I that the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, quote, is established in order to protect the interest of investors and further the public interest. And yet nowhere in the release is the word investor, or for that matter, the words interest of investors or public interest, ever mentioned. And I think investors reading our releases have a right to know how we think they will benefit from them. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of including such a statement in all our PCOB releases. I'd like to see the word investor protection, some explanatory explanation, not in the standard, but in the release. Is that something that maybe we can do on all our releases in the future?
We'll certainly take your comment into under advisement. In our comments today, we're not shy in our all comments to indicate that we believe this enhances investor protection, and we'll work on looking at the language in the release in that regard.
And since I agree with you, I kind of like to see it in the release so that everybody knows it, and it's pretty spelled out.
Yeah, we certainly took that into account as we developed the standard as to what was in the best interest of investors. So, but your points are well made.
Yeah. And how are we continuing to protect investors in addressing the risk of fraud in audits by this proposed standard? I mean, the fraud is an issue of major concern to the investors, and I know that the standards is focused on that aggressively. But could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
In the area of fraud, it touches on in several different places, certainly in both the major sections, one in what's being required to be confirmed and the other in the confirmation procedures. I think it's been discussed, cash is now in the proposed standard to be required to be confirmed, and that's been an area where there has been alleged fraud in company financial statements, and sometimes significant alleged fraud. So that's a requirement. Significant risk, that includes the fraud risk, other types of risk that could result in fraud. So we think extending the requirements to confirmation of specific accounts as we have addresses some of where the major risks have been in fraud that we've seen. And then in the confirmation procedures themselves, maintaining control, making sure the auditors send out the confirmations themselves, not let any other person do that. Receiving them likewise, they can't just have the company do that. We have a requirement to test the validity of addresses. That's a new requirement in the standard to make sure it's not going to a fictitious party, that the auditors need to be aware of that. If management requests the auditor not to confirm accounts, the standard now includes requirements when that happens and what the auditor should do to evaluate that, because there may be a reason that has to do with fraud behind that request not to confirm. Evaluation is another area. So the consideration of fraud really is pervasive throughout the proposed standard.
Thank you. And then Rule 3101 of our rules clearly states that the word must, shall, and is required indicate unconditional responsibilities. the auditor must fulfill responsibility to this type in all cases in which the circumstances exist to which the requirement applies. And the rule goes on to state the word should indicates responsibilities that are presumptively mandatory. The auditor must comply with requirements of this type specified in the board statements unless the auditor demonstrates that alternative actions he or she filed in the circumstances were sufficient to achieve the objectives of the standard, close quote. In the proposed standard the board is considering today, the board uses the word should throughout. For example, and these are quotes, when using confirmation procedures, the auditor should maintain control over confirmation requests and confirmation responses. The auditor should evaluate the audit evidence obtained from performing confirmation procedures. The auditor should design confirmation requests to obtain relevant and reliable audit evidence. If management requests the auditor not to confirm certain accounts, balances, or other items, the auditor should obtain an understanding of management's reasons for the request. If conditions indicate that a confirmation response might not be reliable, the auditor should obtain further audit evidence. And there are other examples. It's been explained to me that the word must is used sparingly in our standards, although not as sparingly as I initially thought. My question here is whether there's any instance in this proposed standard that that term must should be used, and if not, why not?
Well, our view is the word should is a very strong term. As the board defined it, as you said, it's presumptively mandatory responsibility of the auditor to perform that particular audit procedure, and he must comply with the requirements of a should unless he can demonstrate how the auditor achieved the objectives of that otherwise. It also goes on in 3101 to say, in the rare circumstances in which the auditor believes the objectives can be met by alternative means, the auditor, as part of documenting the performance, must document the information that demonstrates how that the requirement was met. We've discussed, as I mentioned earlier, we worked closely with inspections and enforcement as part of writing this standard and all of our standards. And I think we find that should is we rigorously enforce against the words should, and we do use the word must, and as you said, we believe we use it sparingly and in very, very particular circumstances. So we think the word should throughout the standard is appropriate, and we feel that it does provide presumptively mandatory requirements that the auditor has to follow. We don't think the auditors take the word should lightly at all.
And how enforceable is a should versus a must standard?
I guess I'd answer that one by saying our enforcement division rigorously enforces standards that use the word should.
Well, I solicited comments.
Gordon, would you like to comment on that?
Just echo what you said, Marty. I think both should and must are enforceable, in part for the reasons that have been mentioned here, that our rule sets a fairly exacting standard for the auditor who seeks not to do something that is a presumptively mandatory responsibility. So certainly think both terms are quite enforceable.
Well, I mentioned in the statement, that I'd welcome comments from investors or others, not expecting to get any, but it's out there. So I would appreciate any responses. And I would also note, as I say, in our existing standards, it's used a little bit more often than I had anticipated. It's used in all standards. Virtually, there's a must in virtually every one of them, and we can go through it and give you the sections and whatnot, but I don't want to dwell upon that, except to solicit the comments. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the standard setting process and the development of proposals and making our process more transparent, first of all, I want to be totally supportive of you, Marty, and also of you, Mr. Chairman, but this standard has been discussed 10 times now, starting in September 9, 2004. I think that to the extent that we can, we ought to come to closure on these standards a little bit more rapidly than we have. This one is not a complicated standard, and as I said, to the the extent that we can finalize it with a relatively quick turnaround in this process, recognizing the process that we have to go through in terms of the clearance, I think we ought to do it. And once again, I appreciate the aggressive and dynamic standard schedule that you both have put forward. But, you know, reaching closure on these and others, and we do have an aggressive schedule, I think is in all of our interests.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there's no further discussion, let's come to closure on this meeting. I'll put the question to the board of the approval of the motion to propose the confirmation standard for comment. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you very much. If there's no further business for this meeting, we will adjourn.